Mission accomplished, really? Today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. After U.S.-led airstrikes in Syria, President Trump tweeted this, mission accomplished. But was it?
The Pentagon says they will admit that while the strikes did attack the heart of Syria's chemical weapons facilities, they're not completely convinced that they could stop Assad from using them again.
Plus, what conditions are like for most Rohingya refugees in Bangladesh?
Basically, a million people just stacked up alongside this road in plastic hovels. And it's, you know, it's like 100 degrees there during the day, and you get a plastic hovel or tarp over it. It is unbelievably hot inside.
Plus, no men allowed at Saudi Arabia's first ever fashion week. Those stories and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. So, not much happened this weekend. Weekend start fresh today. Very wrong. So much happened this weekend, and it all seemed to begin when we got off the radio on Friday night. Airstrikes on Syrian targets. By the time you woke up on Saturday, the pundits on cable were already back on the Michael Cohen story. We've got a few questions, though, that we wanted answered about Syria, and that's what we're going to do right here at the top of the show today. Idris Ali is Reuters Pentagon correspondent. So talk about these three sites in Syria that were targeted on Friday. Why were they chosen as targets?
Sure. So early Saturday morning, Damascus time, about 105 missiles by the British, French and American forces were fired at three facilities. They're basically associated with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapons program. The first one is basically the research and development facility located near Damascus, and that took the brunt of the strikes. About 75 missiles were fired at that. The other two facilities near Homs in western Syria were really more production facilities and holding facilities for the weapons. And the Pentagon basically said these were chosen because A, they're associated with the weapons program, B, they were the places where civilian casualties were likely to be limited, and then C, it went to the heart of the facilities and the chemical weapons program. And so they feel like these three facilities put together really put a dent in Assad's abilities to use and produce chemical weapons in the future.
So a couple of questions that maybe you've gotten answers to that I have not yet. First of all, how many people were killed in these strikes? Is there a range of numbers or does everyone agree on a number?
So, like most things, there's a lot of disagreement about what happened on Saturday. The United States says that they do not believe that the strikes that they carried out killed anyone, actually. They were going after the equipment and the facility rather than personnel in this instance. They do, however, say that after the strikes had been carried out, all 105 of them, the Syrian air defense systems fired 40 missiles, and they're unsure where those Syrian missiles landed, which may have caused some civilian casualties. So, at this time, there's no confirmed number.
Yeah, and also, if the strikes were targeting chemical weapons, labs, and stockpiles, how come that didn't then release a bunch of chemical weapons into the air?
That's a good question. It was one that was brought up on an early morning Saturday briefing at the Pentagon. And what we were told is the way the strikes were carried out, the payload that was included, was done in a way which would minimize the risk of chemical weapons being released into the air. The Pentagon did claim, obviously, that you know they were assessing the situation, looking at air quality after the strikes to see if any poisonous gas had been released. And we haven't heard of anything until now.
So on Saturday, President Trump tweeted, mission accomplished. But of course, as you say, not all of the chemical weapons facilities were targeted. What do we actually know about Syria's chemical weapons capabilities now moving forward? Like, how much damage did the airstrikes do?
In 2013, when President Obama was in power, the deal was struck and Russia was the guarantor where Syria was supposed to get rid of all of its chemical weapons stockpile. But there are obviously some chemical weapons that have dual purposes, like chlorine was not given up. There's been talk of sarin being used. That stockpile hasn't been given up either. The Pentagon says they will admit that while the strikes did attack the heart of Syria's chemical weapons facilities, they're not completely convinced that they could stop Assad from using chemical weapons again.
What intelligence has the Pentagon not released yet, aside from that?
Sure. Well, that's actually a really interesting question because last year I was here at the Pentagon when Trump ordered 59 Tomahawk missiles at an airbase used by Assad. And at that time, I remember it was a late night briefing that we got and they declassified a lot of images, including, you know, the track the aircraft used, where they dropped the munitions. And there was a lot of details that were given to us to prove that this was Assad who carried out the strikes. This time, it's very different because what the government has said has not been consistent. Secretary of Defense Mattis spoke earlier this week at a congressional hearing where he said, "We know chlorine's been used. We're still trying to find sarin." Nikki Haley and other government officials have hinted that sarin was used. But really, the government at this point hasn't said why they believe chlorine or sarin was used, which is really something that has led to a lot of questions because, you know, the history of the region, especially 03 in Iraq and sort of the dodgy intel that was used in that campaign,
right,
is really coming up. And so far, the Pentagon hasn't been able to provide answers.
So how has Syrian President Assad responded to all this? Does he see these missile strikes as a major loss?
This really hasn't had a major impact on him. He does have other chemical weapons facilities, and B, he has other conventional weapons he can use to really go after the rebels. He met with Russian lawmakers yesterday, who basically said that he was in good spirits and that they don't expect anything to change. And I think a lot of observers would probably agree.
What are you hearing from people at the Pentagon, like people in the Mattis camp, about Assad's conventional weapons? Because, I mean, that's what he's mostly been using on his people in the war, and no one's really drawn a red line around barrel bombs.
Right. I mean, that's a good point. And we're talking about 500,000 people who have been killed over the past 7 years, millions who have been displaced. And really, I think the fact is people have sort of accepted it, and there's no sense within the Pentagon that there's going to be anything done about it. President Trump has said as much. He's talked about pulling out U.S. troops. Questions have been raised about, well, if you're so concerned about chemical weapons, which obviously have killed dozens of people, I think about 60 in this case, what about the other hundreds of thousands that are killed? And the answer seems to be, it's quite sad, but there's nothing we can really do about it.
Reuters Pentagon correspondent Idris Ali, thanks very much.
Great. Thanks for having me.
This next story is not at the level of the war in Syria, but it is an intense geopolitical drama all the same, and is playing out on a tiny spit of land that juts out into the Bay of Bengal between Bangladesh and Myanmar.
It's about 20 or so miles along the beach, but inland a little bit, are refugee hut after refugee hut after refugee hut. Basically a million people just stacked up alongside this road in plastic hovels.
That's David Eubank, a former officer in the U.S. Army Special Forces and Rangers. He's also the founder and head of the Free Burma Rangers, a humanitarian group that aids civilians caught up in conflicts. They've worked in places like Iraq, Syria, and Sudan, and with the embattled Rohingya Muslim minority in Myanmar. Many Rohingya have fled and are now in those crowded refugee camps in neighboring Bangladesh. We caught up with David Eubank in Washington today. He heads back to the region tonight, and he says conditions in the camp are almost unbearable.
You know, it's like 100 degrees there during the day, and you get a plastic hovel or tarp over it, and it's unbelievably hot inside. And very few water points. I mean, the NGOs that are there are doing a great job, but it's just the massive amount of people to provide water, to provide food, sanitation. And I remember I'd go into a little hut, and there would be a woman laying on the floor and a baby, and the baby would smile at me, and the woman would smile, "Oh, and come into my house." There's nothing in there. There's nothing in there.
And all of this after other trauma that they experienced fleeing Myanmar. What kind of stories did you hear?
You know, well, as we were there, a woman came in a little pickup truck and it was offloaded and comes gathering all her possessions. And we asked, "Where did you come from?" "I just came from Burma." I said, "Why'd you come?" She says, "You can't stay. You can't stay. They'll kill you. It's not just the 700,000 and all these people they forced to flee and estimated 7,000 they killed. They're still killing people. And as a woman, you have no rights. You can be raped on the spot and nothing will happen. I couldn't stay anymore." And my daughter gave her a little bracelet and the lady started crying and my daughter started crying. They're hugging each other. And then I turned to this man and he was this maybe 60, 70-year-old man. And he had a little red tinge in his beard and his eyes looked so sad. And I asked through my translator, one of our new Rohingya Rangers, I said, "What's his story?" "He just looks like such a fine man." And the guy said, "I had to come." I said, "Why'd you have to come?" He said, he pointed at the ground, "They killed both my sons at my feet."
Wow.
And then you start crying. And this is the kind of stories we heard. You know, right at my feet, killed them. They didn't kill me. They just let me watch it happen.
So these refugees are in Bangladesh in the city called Cox's Bazar, which is kind of interesting. It was named for an official with the British East India Company back in the 1700s. But now it's a scene of this post-colonial tragedy. Did you find that most of the people in these camps would rather be back home in Myanmar, but they're not going to risk going back and getting killed?
Oh, yeah. They want to go home. They're not welcome in Bangladesh. The Bangladesh government's done a great job of taking them, but no country, especially Bangladesh, can afford a million extra people. And they're taken care of there, but they have no future there. Like one person said, "I don't exist in the world. I have no Bengali ID or citizenship. I have no Burmese citizenship or ID. I'm nobody. I could be killed and nobody will care. I'm not even a number in the world census. And I don't count. Where can I go? I can't even leave the camps. I want to go home. What would it take, I asked them, for you to go home? Well, first, we got to be guaranteed citizenship so that we can't just be arbitrarily arrested. And
well, we hear today from the Burmese government that it's repatriated the first Rohingya family back to Myanmar. I mean, that would suggest a willingness of that family to leave Bangladesh. But we hear the UN and Bangladesh are skeptical of the claim that this family has been repatriated. Is it believable?
I'm not there right now, so I'm not sure if the family went back. And if they went back, you know, why? Maybe they came from a situation where they had a good relationship with the Burma government already and they'd be protected. But that sounds like a sick game to have a family or even 10 families come back when you've got over a million people in need to come back. And that sounds like a carefully contrived show to get the Western world off their backs, off the Burma government backs.
We've heard from relief workers before who've been to these camps. We have not heard, however, from Westerners like you who've actually met with this insurgent group, the Arakan Rohingya Salvation Army, or ARSA. Myanmar's government has called them a terrorist group. Who are they?
Well, first of all, the Myanmar government calls anybody who resists them terrorist. That's zero credibility. And they're actually, Burma has had almost no real history of terrorism, which I hope it continues. We don't know. But we heard about ARSA last year, and then we tried to meet them. And through some of our teams, we were able to meet them on this last trip, my daughter and I. We were led through this labyrinth of a camp, one of the many camps, and you know, handed off here and there and wait here, wait there. Pretty good tradecraft to make sure we weren't being followed and we're who we said we were. And they passed us off to different people. And it took about 2 hours of going here and there until finally met the number two commander of ARSA. The number one commander had gone back into Burma the week previous, so we didn't meet him. And when I met him, pretty unassuming guy, I got to talking to him and I said, you know, what's your goals? What's your objective? He said, freedom for my people. What kind of freedom? You know, independence or self-determination like the Karen? He said, no, we don't need any of that. We just want to be citizens. That kind of freedom. Freedom to be human, to count. Our women don't get raped. I don't get beat up and shot. My house doesn't get burned. That's all. I don't need any political power. And so I asked, people say you're a terrorist. And they go, well, we're not. And if we were, we wouldn't have 30 to 40 weapons, which is all we have. And there'd be a lot more dead Burmese. And the only people we fought and killed are Burmese soldiers and policemen.
Maybe when ARSA attacks Burmese targets, won't Burmese military leaders then feel they've got carte blanche to attack more Rohingya?
Well, yes, I'm sure they would. And they may even like that. ARSA is not a big military threat to them. And 30 to 40 weapons, they told me they had 500 people with a little bit of training, but they couldn't use them because they only had a few weapons. They would circle around a police box and throw rocks at it and shoot and hope the policemen were so few they'd run away and then go get some weapons and then get stronger. I think the way they look at it is like this. If they do nothing, they're going to rot in a refugee camp the rest of their life and they'll never go home. They can't stand it. I'm going to do something, live or die. The only thing Burma Army respects is force. This is what ARSA said. So even though it may be hopeless proposition, even though it may trigger more attacks, we'd rather have them come right now and have a chance to stop it than just let them just continually dribble, 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 attack us till there's no Arakan, there's no Rohingya left in Burma, which is their goal. So my estimate, this is not a terrorist organization, nor do they have terrorist aims. However, they could become one, either out of desperation and because groups like maybe like ISIS would say, hey, we'll help you fix this problem. Here's a bunch of weapons. That is a danger.
David Eubank is a former U.S. Army Special Forces and Ranger officer. He founded and leads a humanitarian aid group, the Free Burma Rangers. Ireland's abortion debate, is change coming? Find out just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. When it comes to abortion, the Republic of Ireland is one of the most restrictive countries in Europe. Right to life for the unborn in Ireland is protected by their constitution. The Eighth Amendment, as it's known, put in place in 1983 by national referendum. It got support from the Catholic Church, and the vote passed by a wide margin. But that was 35 years ago, and next month, Irish voters will take part in another referendum on abortion. This time, they will be asked, yes or no, should Ireland repeal the Eighth Amendment? The World's Matthew Bell was recently in Ireland and heard from people on both sides of the debate about what's at stake.
The Irish government has set a date for the referendum. It's May 25th, and the campaigns for and against repealing the Eighth Amendment are in full swing.
Would you like a leaflet? We're campaigning for a yes vote in the referendum.
Right.
Thank you.
Rachel Brady, a 23-year-old social worker, is handing out leaflets in the town center of Sligo. It's a small seaport on the northwest coast. People in rural Ireland, Brady says, are not as conservative on this issue as you might think.
They're really happy that they're getting a chance to have a vote and to have their say on this, and they think it's time for change because they're aware that abortion is a reality in Ireland every day. You know, it's happening.
Despite
every day,
the ban, Irish women are getting abortions. An estimated 10 to 12 women travel every day to the United Kingdom or other parts of Europe where abortion is legal. Brady's colleagues are holding pink signs that say women's right to choose and vote yes for abortion rights. Many passersby smile in apparent approval, but some stop to engage.
My heart lies in the place.
And to challenge Brady and her colleagues.
Listen, I'm talking as an uncle of a 13-year-old who got pregnant.
Sure.
You know?
Okay, well, look, you know, we're both coming at it from different angles here, I suppose. And thank you for your time.
Thank you for talking to
me. I'm not arguing, and I'm not debating. I just think that life is so phenomenally important, as is the life of the woman carrying it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I'm not diminishing that in any shape or form, and I'm not belittling that in any shape or form.
A few minutes later, a married couple stops to make a similar point. They say they could never bring themselves to vote yes if it means opening the door to, quote, abortion on demand in Ireland. Some of what's going on here is about religion. People are filing out of Sunday Mass at St. John's Catholic Cathedral in Limerick. Marion McDonald tells me the abortion referendum is a huge deal for her. She hasn't discussed it with friends and family, but she knows how she'll be voting.
I'm going to vote to retain the Eighth Amendment.
To keep abortion illegal. McDonald says it's based on her faith, but this is personal too.
I had an ectopic pregnancy. That could have died. But I'm living in Ireland, and that was, I mean, I wasn't allowed, I didn't die, but the baby was born and it had no chance of living outside the womb. So, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. I think it's God's way. I think he created life, and from the womb to the tomb, that's what I believe.
Everyone knows where Catholic leaders stand on the issue of abortion, but the bishops in Ireland have not taken the lead in speaking out publicly against repeal. Bill Daly is an American Catholic priest and a law professor with Notre Dame University. He's been living and working in Dublin since 2016. And he says it's no surprise that Catholic clergy here have largely stayed out of the spotlight on the issue of abortion.
Ireland's experience of church credibility crisis was Boston on steroids.
Daly's referring to the priest sex abuse scandal that broke in the city of Boston. The Irish version of that story was even bigger. People are furious about it all, and it's led much of the Irish public to reject the church as a moral authority. But Daly says Catholic leaders should still speak out against abortion, and he recommends they frame it as a human rights issue, not a religious one.
There are some Catholic leaders who have said this is an important priority for Catholics. Probably the better strategy, the way I would think about it as a person who preaches, is to remind people that this doesn't depend upon any particular Roman teaching. It doesn't depend upon anything that we believe in particular about Jesus Christ, that this is a teaching about human rights that's accessible to human reason, as long as one acknowledges that what we have in the womb is a human life. And most people do understand that. We all know that when our friends are pregnant, we don't say, "How's the fetus doing?" We say, "How's the baby?"
Advocates for legalizing abortion in Ireland also talk about human rights, and they're quick to point to several highly publicized cases. One involved a woman who's referred to in news reports as Miss Y for legal reasons. In 2014, she was an asylum seeker who arrived in Ireland and discovered she was pregnant as the result of rape in her home country. She requested an abortion, but she was denied permission for one under Irish law. She tried to go to Britain and was stopped. She became suicidal, went on hunger strike, and doctors intervened. In the end, her her baby was delivered by what Sarah Monahan says was a forced cesarean after 25 weeks.
You know, we pride ourselves on, you know, on our healthcare and on Ireland being this fantastic place to live. And this woman came here looking, needing help, you know, needing basic access to healthcare and couldn't access it, and then was treated in the most inhumane of ways.
Monahan says the story of Miss Y pushed her to get active. Now she's one of the leaders of the abortion rights campaign in Ireland, and she says it's high time to repeal the Eighth Amendment.
This idea that there is no abortion in Ireland is an absolute fallacy. It's, you know, a fantasy. We have abortion, we just choose to export it elsewhere, and those who are really, truly affected are those who can't access it, who can't travel, who don't have the money, who don't have the documentation, who may be in, you know, domestic violence situations, you know, wide range of reasons that we tend to forget about and we overlook.
Supporters of abortion rights take heart in the fact that Catholic Ireland voted to legalize same-sex marriage in 2015 by a wide margin, even though the church opposed it. Monahan, who's 27, says she's struck by how many Irish women from older generations say they're voting for repeal.
They have really lived this in a way that I haven't and that, you know, never will. And they don't want this for future generations. They don't want this for their daughters and their granddaughters, because they grew up in an Ireland of very dominated by the Catholic Church and shrouded in shame and silence and stigma. And these things were not talked about. And they are absolutely ready for a better Irish society.
The polls show solid support for repealing the Eighth Amendment, but some observers say those polls could be misleading. Veteran anti-abortion campaigner Niamh Ivreen thinks so. She helped organize a Save the Eighth rally in Dublin last month.
Because if you looked at it, it was young and old, it was families, it was immigrants, it was people who've been here forever, it was Catholics, it was people of no faith. It was incredible. And you could see that in the banners, you know, atheists for life, feminists for life, doctors for life, LGBT for life. It was just an incredible cross-section of Ireland, all in this huge, huge rally out to Save the Eighth. And those people were incredibly passionate. You could see that too.
Wherever they stand on the issue of abortion, Irish voters are going to be hearing a lot about it between now and May 25th, the day of the referendum. For The World, Matthew Bell, Dublin.
Support for this podcast comes from LegalZoom. It's a fact of life. Attorneys are expensive. You're likely to pay around $300 an hour. That's just one reason why smart business owners turn to LegalZoom. In fact, over 2 million Americans have used LegalZoom to start their businesses with LLCs, incorporation, and more. But even after your business is set up, LegalZoom can still help you out with things like lease agreements, changing tax laws, and contract reviews. LegalZoom created their business legal plan to help you get legal advice for your business from vetted, independent attorneys and tax professionals available in every state. You also receive access to NDAs, lease agreements, and more. The best part is you won't get charged by the hour, since LegalZoom isn't a law firm. Instead, you just pay one low upfront price. Check out LegalZoom's business legal plan today and get special savings when you visit LegalZoom.com/world. LegalZoom, where life meets legal.
I'm Marco Werman. 5 years after the Boston Marathon bombings, a lot has changed for organizers of all big sporting events.
When you look at these host cities, when they start to put together the pieces of hosting an event, you know, security ends up being a huge chunk of it. And it's why some cities no longer bid for the Olympics.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. As usual, there were cheers today along the route of the annual Boston Marathon, but mostly it was wet. Lots of soggy sneakers pounding out those 26.2 miles, and lots of spectators in ponchos, one of the few items you can still take to the race. Because ever since the 2013 marathon bombings, Boston law enforcement officials have banned lots of things: backpacks, coolers, strollers. They've also brought in bomb-sniffing dogs, set up more security checkpoints, and conducted bag searches, even deployed drones. Juliet Kayyem has been keeping a close watch on how security at the Boston Marathon has changed the last 5 years. She's a former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security. So I've heard that every year since the marathon bombing, marathon security officials create new scenarios and work through them. Is that right? And explain what they're actually doing.
It is. And basically, they're testing how the system would work, given whatever variable it may be. And this happened before the Boston Marathon. In fact, one of the untold stories of the Boston Marathon planning was, of course, that the exercise, the test scenario they went through weeks before the Boston Marathon was bombings was, in fact, detonations at the finish line. And so part of what this process is just to make sure whatever the boom is, so to speak, you know, it could be a generator, it could be a car that, you know, starts to attack pedestrians, that they actually have the resources and the planning to be able to deal with it. I find it actually matters less what the issue is that they're worried about. And what's more important is that you bring everyone together so that they're able to pivot depending on what the circumstance may be.
It's interesting to see very little media coverage of security for this year's Barcelona Marathon in March. Given that last August there was that van that plowed into pedestrians on Barcelona's Las Ramblas, killing 13 people, is the Boston Marathon security plan, where it's well publicized, is it a good strategy, being transparent as a show of force?
I think it's a good strategy. It has something to do both with our city and our country. Each country deals with potential threats and how they plan for them differently. Some of that's based on their history. Some of it is just the tolerance of their security apparatus. Here in the United States, we do tend to, you know, go big and go strong in response to attacks. I think we also here in Boston tend to have a, you know, sort of aggressive attitude about our own security. And so I view our response here in Boston as particularly local and national. Other countries deal with it in different ways. I will say in Europe, the threats that they're facing have caused changes in high-profile events, but mostly in stadium security because of Paris, Manchester, because of the threats they faced in the last couple years.
Yeah, which makes my mind turn to the world's biggest spectator sport, the Tour de France, coming up, which is 3 weeks, 2,000 miles, two sides of the road, very unpredictable. What have you heard from France about how they lock that race down?
So this is once again the challenge of something that's not confined. Just like a marathon, the Tour de France is going to have both sides of a street, many spectators, and then, of course, the riders. And so basically what France has done is it has basically just a security presence every, say, 100, 200, 300 feet, just to make sure you're protecting, in particular, the viewers. Because they're, you know, the bike riders are going through quickly. So what we've done in sort of bike planning is you have sort of a car presence that's going along the route of security presence, as well as a physical pedestrian presence. But you have to remember that for any of these sporting events, in particular ones that are not in stadium, there's always going to be a risk of vulnerability. You simply cannot confine or close them from all potential threats. It would ruin the experience for the athletes, let alone for their family and friends and others who want to come cheer them on.
At the end of the day, Juliet, do you think that the cost and planning and human resources needed to make marathons safe will eventually be too much that cities will have to consider not holding them?
It's a great question. And this is, you know, this goes also to what happens with Olympics, too. When you look at these host cities, when they start to put together the pieces of hosting an event, you know, security ends up being a huge chunk of it. And it's why some cities no longer bid for the Olympics and why some cities may begin to not hold these events. But what you have to remember is for many of these cities, whether it's Paris or Boston or the New York Marathon, the marathon is part of the fiber, the connective tissue of that city. And you can't imagine that city without the marathon. And I think that's true in particular for Boston.
Juliet Kayyem, always good to speak with you. Thanks.
Thank you.
That close relationship between Boston and its marathon, it's what's at the heart of a project called Our Marathon, the Boston Bombing Digital Archive. It was created by a team of professors and researchers affiliated with Northeastern University here in the city. As the name suggests, the archive is home to thousands of images, stories, and sounds all related to the attack 5 years ago. Earlier today, we spoke with the project's co-director, Jim McGrath. He told us the archive includes digitized versions of the things people left at a makeshift memorial near the site of the bombings.
Materials from the Copley Square Memorial have been digitized, posters, sneakers, images, letters that we got from around the world to the city of Boston were digitized, oral histories for people who were variously directly impacted by the marathon or found there too, and then lots of material that was crowdsourced, given to us by a range of different people who wanted to share their stories about their experiences with these events and their reflections.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty impressive if you go online to see the range of stuff, but it's not just inventory, is it? I mean, you were really taking on the task of memorializing an event that shook the community here in Boston. Where did you look to find examples of how events like this should be memorialized, either digitally or otherwise?
One of the biggest precursors to our project is the September 11th Digital Archive. Another project that maybe not as well known is the Japan Disasters Digital Archive Project, which was started out of Harvard University, but obviously has an international focus.
And that was associated with the 2011 tsunami earthquake, Fukushima
yes.
meltdown in Japan, right? What was it about the Japan 2011 tsunami digital archive that you really felt was a good template for the Boston one?
Yeah, so that particular project really starts to wrestle with what do you do with social media and how do you aggregate and curate and archive this sort of wide range of stories that in the immediate context of a Facebook page or Twitter might have more sense, but from the eyes of a historian or an archivist might need a bit of context or information, or even that question of, is this stuff worth saving? Mm. And the challenges from a storytelling perspective of how do you tell stories about this? And then the ethical dimensions of taking this information that people may have thought of as ephemeral and putting it into this new context.
And as you put this project together, what, if anything, have you learned about how the bombing here in Boston in 2013 was experienced outside of Boston, even outside the U.S.?
So we got a host of different letters. For example, we had a collection of letters that were sent to the city of Boston from South Korea from a language academy there. So it's interesting to see, you know, the impact and to have these students reflecting on this work and their teachers doing that. We got a collection of butterfly drawings from a school in Ontario. So you have these sort of creative impulses that are being utilized by students from around the world to send those messages. And we've got postcards from around the world. And then also on the materials that are digitized from the Copley Square Memorial, you can see a host of different countries and cities represented there when visitors to the city or long-term residents who may have come here from somewhere else were documenting where they came from and sort of witnessing this event on that global scale.
And for you, now that you've been involved with this archive for several years now, how does it feel to go back year after year? And have you seen kind of the project change in kind of time elapsed fashion?
Yeah, I mean, it's still hard. I've said that, you know, I have on the historian hat, but I'm also a Bostonian. I've been living in Boston since 2003. So, I mean, that doesn't count to some right. some people in Boston. But I think that one of the things that we tried to do in this project was not run away from the fact that we were directly impacted as much as the people whose stories we're representing in this archive. And so that's changed with time. And we understand that for many people, 5 years might be a long time, but for a lot of the people who were directly impacted by this, these traumatic events still have this sort of immediate resonance. So what we try to do with preserving this historical record is keep those sorts of audiences and perspectives in mind.
Jim McGrath, he co-directs Our Marathon, the Boston Bombing Digital Archive. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks so much.
Cold and wet in Boston, so let's head someplace warm. In 2008, Fidel Castro handed power to his brother, Raul. Fidel died in 2016, and then it felt like Raul truly was in charge. But in just a few days, Cuba is going to turn another chapter. Raul Castro is supposed to step down as president. That means he'll have governed the country for over a decade. It also means that the communist island is getting ready to have a leader who is not named Castro for the first time since 1959. Cuba's likely next president will be Miguel Díaz-Canel, a hardline Marxist-Leninist. My colleague at the BBC, Will Grant, has been traveling across Cuba on the eve of this historic transition to get a taste of how well the revolutionary narrative has been aging.
Cayo Granma is only accessible by ferry. Just one Cuban peso a ticket, which passengers drop into an honesty box, it's the easiest and cheapest way to reach the island that lies at the mouth of the Bay of Santiago. Boxes of frozen chicken thighs from Brazil are stacked up on the deck, and on the wooden benches inside, high school kids giggle and yell over one another. Few tourists venture out to the tiny islet, but one suspects most locals prefer it that way. The Cayos community is aging, isolated, and in need of constant medical attention.
Good morning.
Buenas.
Hola.
Crucial to Castro's revolution is the concept that doctors live in the community itself. In Cayo Granma, that falls to Dr. Clara Luaces. Resources are limited in her simple clinic, but she's proud of the free healthcare they provide.
Considering how far this island is from the city, we have the basic medical equipment necessary to treat this community. There are 651 people here, and we have everything we need at least to treat them and provide first aid.
Doctors like Dr. Clara are careful not to complain about the Cuban healthcare system, as her superiors would consider it borderline blasphemy. However, the problems are mounting up in Cuban hospitals, from infection rates to underinvestment and crumbling infrastructure. I visited the place where the first shots in the Cuban Revolution were fired, the Moncada Army Barracks. In 1953, Fidel and Raúl Castro attacked the barracks in an attempted coup against military strongman Fulgencio Batista. The uprising was crushed and the plotters rounded up and tortured, the Castro brothers fortunate not to be among them. Once they took power, they turned the military base into a school and a museum to the memory of those who died.
Preserved in glass cases are the clothes, rifles and weapons of the radicals who accompanied Fidel Castro and Raúl Castro on that day. With Fidel Castro now dead and Raúl Castro standing down, the next generation of leaders have a real challenge on their hand, maintaining that sense of revolutionary commitment in Cuba.
Pioneers of communism, we will be like Che, chant the children in unison. After health, free education is another central plank of the Cuban Revolution. Cuba scores higher in education than many developed nations, but funds are scarce, budgets thin, and there's a worsening teacher shortage. And critics, especially in Miami, say the education system amounts to indoctrination. Elaine Infante is the head teacher at one of the primary schools at Moncada.
It's a bit ridiculous to accuse us of brainwashing here. Our revolution displays real humanism and it thinks of others. That's why we come to work, not to turn children into militants, but to prepare young people for the future so that they become useful members of society.
If health and education are the untouchable pillars of the Castro legacy, the International Medical School in Santiago combines them both. The university trains young Cuban medics to be sent abroad and receives students from other third world nations to study Cuban medicine.
I'm going to be the first doctor in my family. So that gives me a lot of motivation to be that best doctor, not only for my family, but for all the people of South Sudan.
Elia Gabriel, a student doctor from South Sudan, has had to learn a lot in Cuba, not least a new language.
And you said it was a little bit like difficult, but with the time I get through with it and now I'm speaking good Spanish and I'm getting the knowledge that I'm supposed to get that my people in South Sudan need right now.
In Cayo Granma, fishermen set out their day's catch on the dock, the majority of which must be sold to the state at regulated prices. It isn't an easy life in the more isolated parts of the communist-run island, and most Cubans remain thankful for the free medicine and schooling. The real difficulty, though, lies in still paying for them with a near-stagnant economy.
The BBC's Will Grant reporting there from Cuba. Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman is on a global charm offensive these days. He was recently in the U.S. and Europe talking up the kingdom's moves toward gender equality. Now, not everyone buys what the Crown Prince is selling, but there's no denying that changes, small ones anyway, are afoot.
You know, if we want to give a headline for this year in Saudi, it would be the year of so many firsts. First time Saudi women were allowed into stadiums. First time ever Saudi women will be allowed to drive starting from June. And then you have now the first time ever Saudi has ever hosted a fashion week.
That's my BBC colleague Hanan Razek, who was in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, for this unique event.
For the fashion shows, it's exclusively attended by women. They set up a tent for the catwalks where the models take to the floor, and we have models from all over the world, mainly European. There is only one who's from the Arab country. She's from the UAE. Also, speaking of the designers, we have big names like Jean-Paul Gaultier, also Roberto Cavalli, but we also have Arab designers. And interestingly, we have Saudi designers who, for the first time, they are showing their clothes at home.
And then there were the different dress codes that seemed to govern what the models wore on and off the catwalks.
If you meet them in the lobby or the public events, you will see them wearing abayas, which are like loose-fitting robe-like dresses. But when they take to the catwalk, it's okay here because the audience will be only women. I asked the designers, how about the clothes you're showing? Are you bearing in mind the modest clothing culture here? And they said, no, because Saudi women, many of them are interested in fashion and they go all the way to London or New York to see it.
Talk about disposable income. Still, the BBC's Hanan Razek says not everyone in the kingdom is enthusiastic about change.
I met a couple of Saudis, especially men, and I remember one of them told me, I know the country is changing and the country is opening up, but he doesn't want to lose his identity and he feels that the country is conforming to the Western values and he doesn't like that. That's what he told me. So you would see like not everyone here will accept this with a welcoming smile.
The BBC's Hanan Razek speaking there from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, where she covered the kingdom's first ever fashion week. So let me ask you this. Do you remember the most recent random act of kindness you witnessed? Were you on the receiving or on the giving end? Ruminate on that for the next couple of minutes, because at the end of this final story today, I'm going to tell you how you can be the recipient of a painting created by its subject. His name is Bren Bataclan, a Filipino-American artist living nearby in Cambridge, Massachusetts. A new exhibit of his work is on view now at the Powell Art Center in Boston. Bataclan says his paintings explore his immigrant experience to the United States, from the Philippines to Daly City in California's Bay Area.
My new work is probably my most personal series of work. It's about my immigration experience from the Philippines to the Bay Area. So we moved here in 1981. The first piece is titled Daly City, Our New Home. And in the foreground, there are five characters. They represent my mom, my dad, my older sister, older brother, and myself with our luggages. All of us look really happy except for my dad, because we moved from a five-bedroom home in the Philippines to a one-bedroom apartment in Daly City. So it was a challenging move for him, because we had to start from like zero. We didn't have any money, but all of us were really excited. And one of the paintings at the gallery shows my dad washing dishes and my mom going to work for the first time. So it's sort of like a reversal of roles. Daly City is nicknamed Little Manila because in the 60s, there was a big brain drain phenomenon. So the Filipinos moved to California, and Daly City was not the best place to live, and most folks didn't consider it back then, because it was really, really foggy. And so the title of my exhibit is Kulap, which is the Tagalog word for fog. So it's very, very foggy, and folks didn't really want to live there. And so the houses there were really affordable, and now they go for $1.2 million. The next painting in the series is entitled Driving Through West Virginia, and it's probably one of the kind of scariest experiences I've ever had. It was me driving alone in this empty road. Eventually, I noticed this powder blue car trying to get my attention. So after a few minutes, I looked, and I locked eyes with a whole bunch of teenagers, and I saw them all doing this racist Asian gesture where they kind of pulled their eyes to make them squint. So it was really frightening because, as I said, I was by myself, and I knew that eventually I would have to exit. What if I ran out of gas or I had to use a bathroom? But eventually they did leave me alone. But hands down, that was one of the most kind of frightening experiences I've ever had. The last piece I'd like to talk about is a print version of Liberty for All. And the print features the Statue of Liberty comforting vulnerable folks. What I'd like folks to kind of take in or like experience is that I believe that most immigrants can relate to them. And so they're not just specifically about one group of people. I think they're broad enough that most folks can relate to the challenges of our experience. One thing I also would like to point out is my Filipino-American immigration experience was a challenge, but in comparison to other immigrants' experiences, I feel that I've had a little easier. But, you know, these are still my experiences, and they were hard. And there's hope in the series. And one thing is that I hope we all become more compassionate and kind after viewing the exhibit.
Yes, that would be nice. Artist Bren Bataclan telling us about some of his new artwork exploring his immigrant experience in the U.S. Another thing he shared with us is about how when he first moved to the Boston area, he wanted to fit in, find his community. And one way he did that was by leaving some of his paintings around the city. If you found one and you liked it, you took it. Totally random acts of kindness. The dividend? A smile. And now Bren Bataclan wants to make you smile by giving away two more of his paintings. This will require only a little bit of work on your part. We want you to tell us what random act of kindness you've done for someone or that someone has done for you. Give us the full details, please. Bataclan will pick the two best ones and then we'll send to each of his favorites one of his paintings. Couldn't be easier, so head over to our Facebook page when you get the chance and just drop your random act of kindness details on the pin post. Selections will be made by the end of the month. That's all at the World's Facebook page. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Not random, but always trying to be kind. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.